Thank you all for coming in on a holiday. I want to start by emphasizing two important points from previous lectures, and then we'll move on to discussion of on interpreter. So the first important thing that you should have gotten out of last lecture, in spite of the thicket of Bessel functions that appeared, is a point about couplings and states. Meaning, the general solution of the bulk equations of motion in some asymptotically ADS space near the boundary. So underline means that's the solution of the equations of motion near the boundary. Looks as follows: it solves a second order ordinary differential equation in Z, and so there are two solutions, one of which is the leading term, the other of which is the subleading term, and the thing I've been trying to convince you is that this first term, which is related to the field at the boundary, as opposed to the second term, which is related to the field momentum at the boundary, this term produces a change in changing this thing is associated with a change in boundary conditions, which means we're changing the Lagrangian of the boundary field theory. And that needs to be distinguished, kept carefully distinct from the change in this term, which is a change in the change in the response. So this is a change in the source, this is a change in the response. It's a change in the expectation value of the operator. So this reflects information about the state of the CFT. The state of the field theory that we're describing. Related to this is this formula for the Green's function that we figured out, which is some number, some factors, some the constant appearing in front of the Lagrangian times the response divided by the source. Right? So this is just the usual linear response formula once you believe this statement. And so an important thing to notice about this is that in order to have a pole of this Green's function, for example, if we're thinking about this in momentum space, in frequency space, a pole in this Green's function will happen when there's a value of the momentum and the frequency when A vanishes, but B does not. A vanishes with, say, A of omega goes like omega minus some special value, but B is not zero there. There'll be a pole in the Green's function with non-zero B, or B not vanishing as fast. So this means there's a response at zero source. So this says that those values of the frequency momentum where this happens are the places where the system has a normal mode. It's a quasi-normal mode, depending on whether it has an imaginary part or not. It's an excitation of the system. Yes, please. Good. This is an important question. So thank you for asking this question. So that depends on what you do in the interior of the geometry. So I haven't actually said. So here, this thing solves a second order differential equation. So there's two solutions, right? There are two independent solutions. To specify some relation between them, I need to introduce another boundary condition. And in the case of correlators, that other boundary condition always comes from doing something at a horizon interior of the geometry, either the Poincaré horizon, this region at z goes to infinity in the ADS metric, or the horizon of a black hole that we'll talk about in a second. And it's the boundary conditions there that determine whether the Green's function we're computing is the retarded Green's function or the advanced Green's function or some other one. And so it's that information that says whether or not it's a causal Green's function. Okay, good. All right, so this was the first thing I wanted to emphasize. The second thing I should emphasize is the physics of what's called the warp factor. And this will allow me to emphasize a little bit the generality of this construction, which has been hidden by the fact that I keep saying the letter CFT over and over again. So the gravity dual, the geometry describing the saddle point of some path integral for any Lorentz invariant state of a quantum field theory that has a gravity dual will look something like this. So I'm going to introduce this function W times the Lorentz, the Poincaré metric, the Minkowski metric, and then plus dz squared. So for example, the ADS metric is the special case of this formula where W of z is equal to, what is it, L over z. And more generally, there'll be other solutions, which for example, asymptote to ADS, but where this thing does something different in the interior. And the thing I want to emphasize, there are a few things. One is, this T here, we should think of as the field theory time. Important in our discussion of temperature is that we said that the boundary of the metric is so some small variation in the boundary behavior of the metric is a source in the field theory, which sources the stress tensor of the field theory. That's the statement that the boundary action contains this delta G, K mu nu. Sorry, this is boundary. But, well, at least we think this is also true at the nonlinear level, namely, whatever the metric is that appears as z goes to infinity, is really, we should think up to a factor as the metric that the field theory lives on. So that's just sort of the nonlinear statement. And so in particular, you should think of this time coordinate as the time coordinate theory. And so a consequence of this is that, and also this is the space coordinate in the field theory, a consequence of this is that the size of some object measured in the field theory is related to the proper size, meaning so some object in the field theory is related to some object in the gravity dual, and that object in the gravity dual has some proper size. It lives in this metric. It's a coordinate invariant thing. The coordinate invariant notion of size is something that you compute with this whole metric, which involves this warp factor. And the relationship between the field theory size and the proper sizes comes with a factor of 1 over this factor. And similarly, and I guess these are related by my assumption of Lorentz invariance, and energy in the field theory, so energy is some conjugate variable to this time coordinate in the field theory, is related to proper energy by a factor of Wz in the numerator. Okay. This is the following picture. So here's a picture of the bulk, I'm going to draw the radial direction going down because it's like a gravitational well, this is a good way to draw it because it reminds you that things will try to fall that way. This is the z-coordinate, this is the boundary. So if I have two objects, one of which is sitting here and is pink, and another which is sitting here and is blue, and they're at the same point, say x equals 0, in the boundary, this x is some coordinate in the boundary theory, then according to this, so this is, say, z1, and this is z2, and they're both at x equals 0. This is an excitation, which, you know, it has some size, it has some energy. Then from the point of view of the boundary theory, so here I'm drawing this x space. The pink object corresponds to, it's closer to the boundary, it corresponds to something small. Whereas the blue object, it's sitting at the same point in space, so this is, let's say this is the origin, but it's bigger. Right? That's what this formula says. It corresponds to a bigger object sitting at the same point. And it's quite a mystery from the field theory point of view why it is that there's some sort of notion of causality. Namely, in the bulk, this object and this object are not at the same point, and they're interacting in a relativistic theory in the bulk, and so signals take a while to get from here to here from the field theory point of view. A mystery which I guess has been a mystery which has been understood a little bit more recently by some people. Okay, and so So this is this thing, by the way, I should say, is what I mean by the warp factor. And an important comment about that is that in ADS, this warp factor has the property that it vanishes if you go far enough down, right? So it goes to zero as z goes to infinity. This Poincaré horizon, and this is the statement that there are degrees of freedom in this boundary field theory at all scales, and in particular, many of them, really, order n squared degrees of freedom at all scales. And one way to think about this is that in solving the wave equation, this green scalar operator in the spacetime, you can add an amount in space. We got this CFT answer at all frequencies. And the reason for that, at a technical level, thinking about this equation of motion in the bulk, the reason for that is that for any value of the momentum and any value of the frequency, say, we were able to find a solution of the bulk equation which satisfied the boundary condition at z equals infinity. Basically, just because the demand of the boundary condition that we're imposing is that it's some plane wave there, and so we got a continuous spectrum. Yeah. So what I mean is so I'm comparing. So I'm using the correspondence in this equation. So by here I mean the size of some object in the field theory. That object corresponds to some excitation in the bulk. That excitation in the bulk has some size. It's in the theory of gravity. We should compute its size using this metric. So I mean, so the word proper means that you use the metric to compute the size. Yeah. Yeah, this thing is coordinate invariant. So there's an ambiguity in the definition of the boundary metric by a factor, right? Because you see, if you do the coordinate transformation you were just saying, I can kind of rescale these time and space coordinates by some overall factor. That's related to the fact that in the UV the thing is a CFT, and so there's really no scale, and so you have to sort of pick units before you can calculate anything. Yeah. Okay, there's some sort of resonance here that's else when I stand over here. It's kind of driving me crazy, okay. Yeah, that's the same. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. But I wanted to mention this because it's an opportunity for me to say that this same there are solutions of some reasonable bulk equations of motion, some of which come from string theory, even where the metric is of this form rather of this more general form rather than of this ADS form, and in particular they needn't be scale invariant, and so in the dual of a quantum field theory, for example, with a mass gap, sorry, with a gap, with an energy gap. There's a very simple way to see what needs to happen in the bulk to accomplish that. It's that this warp factor has a minimum. And what that will mean, for example, from the point of view of this wave equation in the bulk, is that this picture will stop at some point, and you have to impose some boundary condition there. And so rather than being a system with sort of an open condition at the bottom, It's like quantum mechanics in one dimension, but where the thing has boundary conditions at two ends, and so of course there's a discrete spectrum. And so so only for special values will there be a solution. For example, only at special values will you find non-zero values of B with zero values of A, and right. Okay, and that will describe a non scale invariant system. So, for example, in this case, the value of the warp factor where the value of Z where the minimum occurs should be interpreted as the energy scale where the gap is. Okay, and so I shouldn't. Yes, please. It means that there's a gap. Yeah. Right. So the region that's being excised is the low energy region. So this is the UV. This is the IRAD. So if it stops here, it means that below here there's no stuff, and here there's nothing. So nothing in a more important sense than just no excitations in the space-time. I really mean, like, at some point the world just ends. And examples are nowhere that happens in a smooth way. And for example, these which describe gauge theories, which are confining. Okay, and I guess something else that I should emphasize at this point, since I'm emphasizing the more general scope of the correspondence besides just relativistic CFTs, something else I should emphasize is that we do also know a little bit about some, even the UV behavior differs from ADS. For example, yes, please. Yeah. A maximum size. The thing that corresponds is confinement. It means think of it. I mean, if you like, it's the correlation length. It's the. If in the UV you were talking about a gauge theory, then yes. Well, then I would just say it's a math. There's a math gap. There's a gap. Yeah. Good, right. Yeah. Good. Does anyone want to improve my answer to these questions? Yes, please. Conformally thought. No, not necessarily. So this was actually, I guess, the conformal finiteness was a consequence of the assumption of Lorentz invariance. And so, yes, about to mention certainly rules that out. So the thing I was about to mention is we also know a little bit about how theories which in the UV are actually non-relativistic field theories. And I guess we'll hear about that next Wednesday, Tuesday, when? Wednesday, okay, good. All right. So now we're ready for finite temperature. So here I was several symmetries of this of the state of the field theory we were describing. So I was assuming scale invariance. Well, when we had this answer, I was assuming scale invariance, and here also I was assuming Lorentz invariance. And a nice way to study systems which break both of those symmetries is just to take even one of the simplest things, take a CFT, and put it at finite temperature, right? So a CFT, the temperature is a scale. The solution dual to a CFT at finite temperature certainly won't have that symmetry. And in particular, the scale introduced by the temperature is of course one that only affects the low energy modes, and so you expect the region of the geometry near the boundary end not to be affected. And so to find the saddle point for a path integral for such as a CFT in some ensemble like the canonical one, we need some geometry that approaches ADS at the boundary and which solves the same equations of motion. Right? We want it to be a solution of a state of the same system. And okay, so this is how to describe finite temperature. And so so we want a solution of the same equations of motion. Which goes to ADS at the boundary. Is there a question? No? Heckling? Okay. So such a solution. So here I'm going to use the same bulk action that we've been talking about. So just an Einstein-Hilbert term and a negative cosmological constant. Such a solution can be written in the following way. So the metric is nearly the same. The only thing we need to do is stick in what I think can only be called and blackening factors. So we stick in a little function of z here and a little function of z, and that turns the thing that was just pure ADS into a black hole. And so the solution, so you can take this ansatz and plug it into the equations of motion, you get some nice ordinary differential equation for F. The solution is 1 minus something that dies near the boundary. And so the first is that this term goes away near the boundary. It goes to 1 as z goes to 0. And so that, if I set this F to 1, this is just a to s. So that satisfies this criterion. I claim it solves the equations of motion. It's a good exercise to check. So this is the first feature. And this thing has a horizon. It has a horizon at z equals zh. So this thing is very similar to the Schwarzschild metric that Gary wrote down. So by a horizon here, I mean that gtt, the coefficient of dt squared in the metric, has a zero. In this case, it has a simple zero. And gzz has a pole, a simple pole, at the same place. And this has the effect of making the geometry look like this. If I draw time going this way, here's z equals zero. And so this isn't any kind of fancy conformal diagram. I'm just drawing this coordinate time. This is the real coordinate. There's some place, z equals zh, where something special happens, where this thing vanishes. And you can convince yourself that this fact where did my chalk go? The fact that gtt goes like z minus zh, and gzz goes like 1 over z minus zh. There's some factor here, which I guess this is a kappa. This is a kappa. We'll talk about kappa more in a second. This means that if you look at light rays in the space-time, if you look at null GD6, that the ones over here can escape to the boundary. Maybe they move. Yeah, they do something like that. The ones here just skim along the horizon, and the ones here never come out. And so this means that all the stuff to the left of this line, all the stuff at larger values of z, just cannot possibly influence what happens out here. And so we can forget about it. Okay, maybe that wasn't the most effective pedagogy. Okay, yeah. So we can just erase it and set some boundary conditions at the horizon. I guess there's one more thing I should say about this. A difference between this and the black hole. So there are two important differences between this and the black hole solution that Gary wrote down. So the first one is that this one is a black hole in Anton de Sitter space instead of a black hole in Minkowski space. But the other important difference is that the horizon of this black hole, it's by which I mean the locus z and t equals n, so it's a thing that's a point in this picture. Rather than being a sphere like it is in the Schwarzschild black hole that Gary talked about, it's the set of points surrounding a point in space, which everybody agrees is a sphere. In this case, it's just described by this line element. The horizon is it's a copy of R to the d minus 1, right? It's just space, and so this thing has a translation invariant horizon rather than a spherically symmetric one. And so sometimes people call this a black brain, distinguish it from a black hole. Just to emphasize that point, I will not make that distinction. You just have to know what I mean. Then it's a sphere. Yeah. So, but since, as I tried to emphasize, the space that appears here at the boundary is the one that the field theory is living on, I think certainly if one's interest is in condensed matter systems, it's a little bit difficult to construct them on the sphere. Though I think it would be very interesting if people could make quantum Hall systems on two spheres or something. Euclidean version. Yes, I am. Yeah, in fact, is that next? That's next. Yeah, I am. So as you'll recall from Monday, seems like a long time ago, there space-times with horizons are related somehow to thermally mixed states. Now, one way in which this relation is the case is that black holes radiate. Quantum mechanically, black holes will emit some black body radiation. That's actually not the connection that's most important here, because as has been emphasized, the the case in which we understand the correspondence the best is when the gravity theory is classical. So just when we think about things at leading order and n squared. And Hawking radiation really is a quantum effect. But nevertheless, there's a very important sense in which this solution that I've just written down describes the field theory of finite temperature. And that's exactly the way that Gary described, which we can see as follows. So near the horizon, we can rewrite this metric in a way just like Gary did. The metric looks locally like we can introduce some coordinate d rho squared, which is related to the radial coordinate. This is plus things of order z minus zh, where rho squared, is defined to be, it's 4 over f prime, the slope of f at the, I think there might be a minus sign, the slope of f at the horizon times z minus zh, and this is, I guess, plus order. We can put plus order z minus zh, which we don't care about, and kappa, this letter appearing here, is the same kappa that appeared here. It's the slope of the emblackening factor divided by 2, I believe. And this thing has a name. It's called the surface gravity. So if you see that word, it just means the thing that goes there. And so one interesting fact about this metric is that it's an analytic function of its arguments of the. And so we can analytically continue it to the complex plane. In particular, it's interesting to think about the complex time plane, as all of you know from thermal physics. And so in the Euclidean section, this where tau, what we call tau, is it, this metric looks like plane. Polar coordinates, rho and tau, and then plus this flat bit. So if, as long as tau has the right period, the origin of the plane is a smooth point. And so this is a regular Euclidean solution as long as we identify tau, as long as we identify kappa tau, this is the thing appearing here, by itself plus 2 pi, which and the way to think about this is the following. This Euclidean geometry that I wrote here, the one whose near horizon limit is this, is a solution of motion. It's a regular solution only if the identification of the Euclidean time coordinate is this. And so this, so since I've said, I think maybe 5 times already today, that the boundary, the behavior of this the bulk metric near the boundary is the metric that the field theory lives on, is the space the field theory lives on. It means that this particular solution, this particular saddle point of the Euclidean path integral, only contributes in the case when we're considering the field theory on a space-time where we've identified the Euclidean time with this period. Okay? That's the reason that black hole has something to do with the field theory of finite temperature. Good. So the statement is, we're thinking about doing some Euclidean path integral of the field theory, right? So meaning, it's a field theory on a space with on a space-time with t plus 1 over tau. Tau is tau plus 1 over t. And so we know how to do the field theory path integral using this auxiliary gravity description. And the statement is, we know a saddle point of that gravity theory, where the gravity theory lives on a space where the Euclidean time is periodic. And it's this one. But there's a relationship between the parameter, between this, the parameters appearing here, and the Euclidean time, which is exactly the one that we derived here. So this gets a contribution from this metric that we've written down, only in the case when t, which is kappa over 2 pi, according to this formula, is equal to this f prime at the horizon divided by 2 divided by 4 pi which if you plug in the form of the Black-Mead factor to this expression is d over 4 pi zh. So the statement is that black hole, its Euclidean version, contributes to the Euclidean path integral only if the field theory is living on a space where the Euclidean time has period t. So that black hole with parameter zh contributes to the field theory only if zh and t are related that way. Okay? Does everybody agree? Okay, so this black hole, its Euclidean version, contributes to the sum over geometries with boundary conditions so that the Euclidean time is periodic with period 1 over t, only if t is related to the parameter in the black hole solution, this zh, by this particular relation. Because otherwise, it's not regular at the horizon. Yes. Yeah, that's what we did. Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think it's a commutative box. Yeah. Fair enough. That's right. There's a conical singularity, right? So rather than a plane, you get something that looks like this. Well, okay, so I guess, yeah, this is a tricky question. So one reason this is a tricky question is that we don't really know how to do the sum over geometries in the bulk, right? So maybe somebody has a better argument, but I guess, well, is it true? Yeah, so maybe you get some contribution to the action from this tip here, and you can reduce that by making it flatter. I don't know. Does anybody have a good answer to this question? It's a little dicey. Yeah. Agreed. I agree. So maybe one way to think about it is you could imagine that the correct theory has higher curvature terms for which this conical singularity does have a non-zero contribution. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's behind my horizon. Yeah, not the Euclidean. Good. Yeah, that's right. The Euclidean black hole solution does not, right? Because this thing in the Euclidean solution is the whole solution, right? There's no thing behind the horizon. Good, thank you. Yeah. Right, because there's so many other things to worry about in the Euclidean. Yeah, I think it's fair to say that this point is not completely understood. Certainly not by me. We're getting there. Yeah, so far we work on equilibrium. Right. Well, I don't know. The word state is tricky, right? I think it's a contribution. It's maybe a contribution to the path integral, which isn't an extremum of the action. It probably appears in fluctuations, but. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's a bigger issue, maybe. Okay, so having made clear that I don't know the answer to this question, let me move on. So a few more things we can do just by staring on the board is we can ask, what is the area of the horizon? A reason that we're interested in this is because of Bekenstein. The area of the horizon, let's just first evaluate it, naively is square root of g, where here I mean the metric at fixed t and fixed z is zh, times an integral over the space coordinates. And so you immediately see that this is infinite, right? Because each of these runs from minus infinity to infinity. And so let's regulate this by putting the field theory on a, let's just periodically identify these space directions. Let's think of it as a torus with some volume V. And so this this evaluates to L over ZH to the D minus 1 times the volume of that torus, just the volume of the coordinate space. And so we can think of this as like an area density. And in which case, the entropy density, the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy density, which I'll call little SBH, to distinguish from big SBH, which is infinite. So okay, it's extensive. This is the area of the black hole over, so this is this area, let's just call this A. This is A over 4 g Newton. This is the Bekenstein-Hawking formula divided by V, which if I, I should probably have left more room for this. Ah, okay, I know the secret. Good. This is equal to, there's a factor of L to the D minus 1 over G Newton, right? So the L comes from here, the factor of L comes from there, and the G Newton comes from there, times some numbers, which, all right, let me just write the numbers we get. Okay. You should ignore the numbers. Times the important factor of the temperature to the d minus 1. Right, so here I use the relation, so to get from here to here, I use the relationship between ZH and the temperature that's demanded by this condition that we were just discussing. And so all of the factors in this formula are recognizable except for the numbers, which who cares about. This T dependence here is the Stefan-Boltzmann law for a bunch of massless stuff in d space-time dimensions, right? And this follows just from dimensional energy, right? There's no other scale besides the temperature, and so the entropy is dimensionless, and so of course it has to be extensive, and so just to make up the units, that has to be a factor of t to the d minus 1. And this factor here appearing in front, as you'd expect from thinking about just a radiation in a box, this thing is the number of degrees of freedom per point. Right. This is the number of degrees of freedom per site that we've been talking about. This is the thing that I called n squared. Right. And so everybody should be happy that we got that factor in the entropy density. Okay. So let's talk about how to think about this. I guess I've already said. But so really, this calculation of thermodynamics that we're doing is not at all different from the usual way you calculate the thermodynamics of some system if you can compute its partition function. It's exactly the same idea. The only difference is the way we're computing the partition function. So what we're saying is that the partition function of the conformal field theory is a function of temperature. We can compute by doing this funny, which I guess, right, so this is e to the minus beta f. We can compute this by doing this funny, we'll come back to that. This funny e to the minus s Euclidean action of g. Okay, and so we more or less know exactly what this Euclidean action is. So this g underscore is this saddle point with the right asymptotics to have the right periodicity of Euclidean time. We more or less know what this is. Let me just put a. I call this S bulk. Let's just call this S. Sorry for the indecision. The thing I mean by this Euclidean action, it differs from the thing we've been using previously. Only by boundary terms. about which we need to be a little bit careful here. So there's this Einstein-Hilbert action. Integral over all the dimensions. The Einstein-Hilbert term, the cosmological constant. And then there are a few, there are two boundary terms that I want to talk about because they're important if you actually ever want to do such a calculation. So there's a, so we have this regulated boundary. And I'm going to introduce a little bit of notation. There's this capital theta thing, and there's some fact, some constant here, and then there's some dots. Okay, these aren't, those aren't string theory dots. Okay, we're, so I've introduced two new symbols in this formula, this gamma and this, or maybe I talked about gamma, and this theta. By gamma, I mean the boundary behavior of the metric. So near the boundary, we can write the metric in the following form. So gamma is really the boundary metric, up to factors of z. And theta here is the extrinsic curvature of the boundary. It's by definition some derivative of the normal vector to the boundary. It measures how curvy the embedding of the boundary in the spacetime is. And if you plug in an explicit form for the metric, this n here, this n is a unit normal to the boundary. And to get the sign right, it has to be outward pointing. To the boundary at z equals epsilon. Okay, and if you, so if you plug in, it only has a z component, and it has this simple expression. I think this is right. In terms of the metric. Okay, so that's the definition of all the symbols. Now let me talk about why I wrote them. So this thing here is called the Gibbons-Hawking term. And the reason to put it there, so this is a term very much like this this term that we talked about when I mentioned last time there was the special window of operator dimensions where there's a choice about which of the two fall-offs of the field you think of as the source and which you think of as the VEV. And I said that by adding boundary terms, you could change the boundary conditions so that you could exchange the two. And this term is just like that. It's a term involving the extrinsic curvature. So it depends on derivatives of the metric. And so it changes the boundary condition. It changes the boundary terms in the variation of the bulk action. And the reason to introduce it is the following. It's that variation of this Einstein-Hilbert action in the bulk, under a general variation, you get bulk terms proportional to the equation of motion. And then to figure out the equation of motion, you have to do some integration by parts that produces some boundary terms. Plus a term on the boundary. And the terms you get are of the form, are of a form which involves derivatives. This is a radial derivative of variations of the metric. But I've been sort of implicitly in everything I've been saying, we've been thinking about this path integral that we're doing here as a Dirichlet problem for the metric, in the sense that this this boundary behavior of the metric, you know, that we're putting the field theory on some space with some definite metric, some definite periodicity of Euclidean time, that's something that we're specifying in which configurations we're summing over in the path integral. That's the boundary condition we want to impose, and we want in the sum, we want this. What we mean by a solution is that it should be a point that's stationary under an arbitrary variation of the metric under that's allowed by the boundary conditions. And so in particular, such a term would mean that the thing we're studying is not a solution. And so the role of the Gibbons-Hawking term is to cancel off this boundary term. Okay. And so it's a sort of technical point, but it's quite important for getting the right answer, and it's very much in the spirit of the sort of classical mechanics problem that we're thinking about. Okay, so this is just so that it's really a Dirichlet problem. So the metric, it cancels off this thing. Okay. Okay. Sorry. And then this thing, this extra constant term, this is exactly like the local counter term that we added in the two-point function calculation to cancel off this horrible ultraviolet goo that we found, this contact term. And so this thing cancels off some similar horrible ultraviolet goo in this calculation of the free energy. And you can fix this coefficient either by demanding that it do that or by doing some other fancy thing that I still don't understand. And these dot, dot, dots are related to intrinsic curvatures of the boundary metric, which are interesting if you're studying a field theory on a space with curvature. Okay. Are there any questions? That was a little bit brutal, maybe. Yeah, please. I'm saying it would be if we didn't add this term. If we didn't add this term. That's the idea. That's exactly the idea. Yes. Precisely. Good. There's just a bunch more indices. Yeah. Okay, so now we can evaluate the free energy. I'll tell you the answer. I find it's best to do this with Mathematica. I don't know. Does everybody agree with that? Does anybody do it by hand? Okay, Andre says no, then nobody does. All right, so let's figure out the free energy. So the free energy, according to this formula, is, okay, if I get the factors right, plus the Euclidean action, including these boundary terms evaluated on the solution, times t, this is beta is 1 over t, which turns out to be minus l to the d minus 1, volume to the d minus, so the volume of space, divided by 16 pi g newton times this zh to the d. So the only thing that was in question was really the prefactor, because the dependence on ZH was determined by dimensional analysis. Okay, and if I turn this into the temperature, this gives the following answer. There's some factors. By the way, the factors that I'm writing are the answers for the n equals 4 theory, where I know exactly the relationship between g newton over between l to the d minus 1 over g newton and n squared. So just to produce definite formulas, I'm using those answers. And so, okay, so a few things to point out about this. Again, this is proportional to n squared. Again, we get the right power of temperature. And most importantly, a good check on the calculation that we just did is that the entropy of the black hole, which we computed using this calculation over here, which only cared about the geometry near the horizon, right? We only used information about the geometry near the horizon there. We can compare to the answer that we get from this free energy using the usual formula from thermodynamics, and it gives the right answer including factors, unless I made a typographical error. Right, this differentiating this cancels the d. I think it works. Okay, and as Pavel has emphasized to me, I think it's a really very interesting check that the calculation is consistent because as I said, this is just local near the horizon. This is information just about the horizon, whereas this free energy calculation that we did involves quite explicitly an integral over the whole bulk geometry. This knows about the whole solution, and yet it's consistent. And so, and not too distantly related to that statement is that the thermodynamics that we get from this satisfies the first law that the energy is TdS plus PdV, where by P I mean the usual thing. It's minus that. And I guess let me comment at this point because I'm not going to get to later. If we were studying a black hole that had charge or angular momentum, there would be a few more terms in here. There would be an omega dj. Omega is the angular potential, that's the angular momentum. And if it had charge, there would be a scalar potential dq term. And that will work out. Okay, and then finally, there's a very important difference between this black hole and the black holes in flat space that Gary was talking about, which is that this black hole is thermodynamically stable. So if you look at the formula that I just wrote for the free energy, you can convince yourself that the specific heat is positive. And this is in sharp contradistinction to the thermodynamics of a black hole in flat space, but it's what you would hope for a bunch of radiation of a physical system that isn't going to explode. Okay, so I should mention a few more observables that can be computed using exactly the technology that's on the board. One is it's possible to compute the whole CFT stress tensor just using the technology that we've introduced. So this you can compute by differentiating the some factors, the on-shell action with respect to some small variation of the boundary a boundary metric. And if you do this, you can convince yourself that you get the same answers for the energy and pressure that you get just using the thermodynamics. And they're indeed related by the relation that they must be related by to be consistent with scale invariance. And I guess there's one more piece of information. The case where the field theory lives on a sphere, is actually quite interesting for two reasons that I think are worth mentioning. One is, using these terms that appear here, it's actually possible to compute the Casimir energy. You get the right answer. And the second reason is that in the case where you put the field theory on a sphere, so meaning that that the boundary theory is living on a space which is something like S3 times S1, it turns out that in this calculation here, we're saying the partition function is equal to the e to the minus s value at the saddle point. In this other case, there's actually more than one saddle point. And the two saddle points actually exchange dominance as the temperature is varied. And they, in fact, correspond to spacetimes with different topology. And this phase transition that's described this way is one that we know has to be there in field theory. And so this is, I think, the best evidence that we have that quantum gravity involves a sum over topologies. I think that's an important point. It's a good lesson. Of the field theory. Yeah, that's the idea. I mean, if the black hole is the only entropic object, so you can this is an important question actually. So you could imagine a situation where there's stuff going on outside the black hole, which can have some degrees of freedom that you're tracing over. Yeah, so some explicit examples of that are known actually, with like 18 supercharges or something. Sorry, I'm going to see. Yeah. Right, exactly. It's a first order transition. Yeah. I think it might be hard to have a continuous transition where the topology of the bulk changes. Yeah, I believe that such a thing might, I don't know one. I don't know, let me say, I don't think I know one. Yeah. I don't think there is. Does anybody know one? The topology of the brain. Good. Yeah, that's a good example. Yeah, good. So, it's close. Good. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so I hope these calculations that I've shown convince you that black holes are related to field theories in equilibrium. Right? And so Gary gave this beautiful discussion on Monday of these no-hair theorems for black holes. And this is the statement that that black holes are more or less unique. How do you spell that word? I don't know. Okay, let's just not write that. So uniqueness of black holes, the fact that stationary black holes are described by very few parameters, it's a statement very very reminiscent of the statement that thermodynamic equilibria are labeled by very few state variables. And I really don't know how Gary managed to restrain himself from mentioning this when he was talking about it. And similarly, the fact that if you perturb a black hole, it exhibits this phenomenon that it decays back to its stationary configuration. In flat space, this happens either by radiating the energy away, or by the energy of the excitations falling into the horizon. In empty de Sitter space, this happens only by the energy of the excitations falling into the horizon, because there is no far away for this stuff to go. This phenomenon of ring down of the black hole via its quasi-normal modes is precisely describing the approach of the field theory to equilibrium, starting from some perturbation. Gary was one of the people who pointed this out, and so I really don't know how he resisted saying that. And the presence of the horizon in the bulk geometry is really the origin of the dissipation in this process, in the sense that the stuff falls into the horizon, it doesn't come out. It's just completely gone from the point of view of the stuff outside. And so this is where the irreversibility comes from in this discussion. I shouldn't say more about that. Okay, so next, I want to talk about small perturbations of the equilibrium, so just linear response. But as Larry mentioned in the discussion on Monday, he and Paul Chesler have done these really, really amazing calculations where they studied approach to equilibrium from very, very far away. And hopefully he'll have a chance to teach us how to solve PDEs so more people can do similar calculations. You pinged it. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the ways of pinging on the both-end side. Good. Okay, good. I have to answer this question carefully, because otherwise we're going to run into the black hole information paradox, we're very close to it right now, right? Because let's see, what did I say? Well, I think I probably don't have to answer that question, what happens when you do linear response? Suppose you have some system at thermal equilibrium. You introduce some small perturbation of the Hamiltonian. You measure the change in the expectation value of some observable. Where does the energy go? You put in some infinitesimal amount of energy, right? You're thinking of finite volume. Does it matter? Well, but you're saying that the black hole should get a little bit bigger. Right. This is definitely worth discussing. I'm sure there's a good answer. I think I have to think about it a little bit. Does anybody? Yeah, good. right. I think that's a very good answer, yeah. Can you see it in perturbation theory in 1 over the number of degrees of freedom?
Yeah, it's an extraordinary thing. One cube has a finite number.
Right. Right. So certainly, if you could do it, if you could do the correct calculation, you would see it. Can you see it? I think maybe it's worth wondering whether you can see it in perturbation theory 1 over n squared. It's not obvious. Okay. Good. That's a very interesting question. All right. Before I talk about transport, I do want to say a few things about finite chemical potential that to amplify on the things that Chris said yesterday. So suppose that in addition to a stress tensor, the field theory that we're talking about, the CFT that we're talking about, let's say, also has some conserved current, some global conserved current, which I'll call J. And this means that in the bulk, the bulk is always on the left. This means that in the bulk, there's a massless gauge field. The fact that the current is conserved means that the thing is massless. And by the same kind of Wilsonian naturalness arguments that I think we should all just agree on for a little while until we understand everything about the simple calculations, a good action, an action that we know is good in the bulk, is just the Maxwell action for this gauge. And so contract all the indices with the bulk metric. This F is field strength. The Maxwell equation near the boundary, just the variations with respect to A, implies that the behavior of a solution near the boundary is of the following form. There's some constant term, some term that's constant independent of z, so z to the 0, plus some term that goes like z to the d minus 2 times this other thing. And so, naively, this thing is the source and this thing is the vent, but in fact, this is actually in that special window, a particular case of this formula where we think about the modes that are constants in space and time. And then let me just think about the time component. So in particular, the time component of the gauge field has a bit which goes, let me call the leading term mu, and the subleading term, let's call it rho, like Chris did. And the statement I've just made is a demonstration that Chris wasn't lying when he said that the charge density of the boundary theory is related to the electric field of the bulk. And the reason I say that is because, this is just two pieces of information. So this confirms. Let me write it here. This confirms the claim that rho is the electric field in the bulk, because remember I said that the subleading term of the field in the bulk, the leading term is related to the boundary behavior of the field, the subleading term is related to the field momentum at the boundary. And surely everybody will agree that the field momentum associated to A sub t I realized what I was just worried about. It's the field momentum thinking of the radial direction as time. The radial direction is the time coordinate. All right, so if the time were the time coordinate, then the field momentum for A sub t would be 0. So this is and this is the electric field. Which is this equal to this subleading term, which I've just said is equal to rho in this special case. Okay. So good. So Chris wasn't lying there. To describe the field theory in an ensemble with fixed, say, chemical potential, the saddle point should be some solution of the equation of motion where this gauge field is forced at the boundary to approach approach this constant mu. And there is again a black hole solution, which is a charged black hole in ADS. It has some non-zero electric field. And the form of the metric is the same. I won't write it again. The only difference is the form of the emblackening factor. And the gauge field also has a non-zero profile. And the profile is exactly this constant, some constant that I'll call mu, minus some other constant that I'll call rho, to the d minus 2. So it's just exactly the asymptotic form everywhere. That's a nice thing. I'll write the form of the emblacking factor. Let me write it over here. And f is 1, again, in asymptotes to ADS, minus some m times z to the d. So this is just like the previous thing where I've just called n is 1 over zh to the d. And then there's a new term, which is related to the charge. So these two parameters are related to the mu and the temperature. There's one quick point I want to make. I said that we can fix mu. Fixing mu is the grand canonical ensemble. In that case, we think of this as the source, and this is the response. But doing a very similar trick with the boundary term, like the Gibbons Hawking term, if we add some delta S boundary, is some A times n dot dA. To change the boundary conditions of the gauge field, we can go to the canonical ensemble, where it changes the roles of these two things. This thing, we fix rho at the boundary, this thing becomes the source, and that produces a chemical boundary. Think of it as the expectation value. So I mentioned that this business of changing the boundary conditions was like a Legendre transformation. In this case, it is literally the usual Legendre transformation between these two ensembles. Okay. So the new feature from this emblackening factor is that this thing, instead of just having this one zero at the horizon, has multiple zeros. It has multiple roots, and this leads to the following. Okay, here's the radial direction. Here's the boundary, and I emphasize this because this geometry is actually an interesting example of this possibility that came up, maybe it was 2 days ago, of having some RG flow, some explicit RG flow, which is described by a bulk geometry. And the sense in which this is the case is the following. This is the UV end. There's some infrared end over here. And in the UV end, we've demanded that this metric asymptote to ADS d plus 1, right? If I look at small z here, this vanishes, f goes to 1, the metric is just the ADS metric. There's some crossover value in here. There's some value of z, which it turns out to be a value of z, which is of order mu over t. And let's think about the case where, consider, just for interest, because it's more interesting, the case where mu is much, much bigger than t. So it's a CFT at finite temperature, finite chemical potential. So this is the low temperature regime. There's really only one dimensionless parameter. I'm taking mu over t much bigger than 1. There's this crossover regime. And so over here, there's some biggest root, sorry, smallest root of the emblackening factor. This is what's called z equals z naught. It's the smallest root. It's the root of this function, which is closest to the boundary. It's the one you hit first. And then there's some other root of it, which is, this is a horizon. This is a horizon. And then there's another root of it past here, which I'll draw dotted because you can't get there. And let's call it z1. And, the region of the geometry over here, so you can compute the temperature of this thing using exactly the same technique, and you can convince yourself that the t goes to zero limit, in the t goes to zero limit, these roots of this function collide, right? So the distance between these is proportional to the temperature. so they collide, they have the Black-Hund factor has a double zero, the geometry is funny. And the way in which it's funny is that it becomes ADS2. It becomes ADS2 times r to the d minus 1. The near horizon geometry of this black hole and this limit that the temperature goes to zero, which by the way is called the extremal black hole, because it's the coldest it can get, it's extreme. The limiting geometry is ADS2 times r2, and at finite temperature in this regime, it's actually a black hole in that geometry. Okay, so the thing I want to emphasize here is that is the following. This ADS2 geometry has isometries which include scale invariance. The region over here has a scale invariance exactly like any ADS we've been talking about, but it's a different scale invariance than the one associated with the CFT and the ultraviolet, the CFT that we started with. We broke that scale invariance by putting the thing in front of chemical potential. And so this scale invariance here is emergent in exactly the way that this kind of criticality is emergent in like real systems, except that it's emerging from the dynamics of a whole bunch of CFT stuff rather than from interacting electrons or something. So this thing is associated with some sort of non-relativistic CFT, right? In the sense that the time direction, which is participating in this ADS2, is clearly distinguished. The boosts are broken because by the finite chemical potential. Good. And so what I wanted to say about this is that if you study a charged boson in this geometry, you get this phenomenon of holographic superconductivity that Chris talked about. But if instead you study a charged spinner field in this geometry, that corresponds to a fermionic operator in the boundary theory rather than some sort of order parameter field. And so you can compute its charged boson. This leads to this holographic superconductor. If instead you study a charged fermion, a charged spinner, that couples to some fermionic operator O, which is, it's just like these other operators I'm talking about. It's some sort of trace of some bunch of adjoints maybe, but involving an odd number of fermions. So it's fermionic. If you compute the two-point function of this operator in this background, in the kind of way that I'll describe in a second, you can compute. It's very easy to compute the spectral density of this operator, and so this kind of calculation was initiated by Sung-sik, and recently a bunch of us have been working on it, and the answer is that you see Fermi surfaces, and sometimes it's a non-Fermi liquid, and sometimes it's what's called a marginal Fermi liquid. So Hong will talk about this next Tuesday. Yeah. This was bonus over here. That was an advertisement for Hong's talk. It's possible to take the zero temperature limit. Yes, that's right. No. In that limit, the only scale is the chemical potential. Finite density. It goes from being this ADS d plus 1, which describes a relativistic CFT in d dimensions, to being ADS 2 times r d minus 1. So this is space. This is the space. These are the space dimensions of the field theory. And the time direction is in here. Right. It distinguishes the time direction. So that's the sense in which it's not relativistic. Yeah. And it's, I mean, just meaning that there's some reference range. There's some fixed reference range by the density. Yes, please. Yeah. We need the ADS coordinate. Yeah, that's a little bit of a complicated question. You mean the radial coordinate? Oh, you mean the field theory coordinates? This is an interesting question. We should talk about it later. The question is whether the transformation is not local. I think so one reason to ask this question is whether the scale symmetry here is the one that scales towards the Fermi surface. I think the answer to that question is actually no. But yeah, this is a question for later. good. Because, yeah, was there a question? Okay, sorry. So, because I do want to talk about an actual calculation of a real time something or other. Okay. So I'm going to follow the logic of the paper by Iqbal and Liu in this discussion. And so I just want to show an application of this prescription for computing real-time things, and along the way we'll derive the viscosity for this class of of CFT plasma that whose equilibrium configuration we just described. So let's perturb this equilibrium. And so suppose in the boundary action, let's go back to some scalar-looking thing. There's some operator O, and its coupling is phi naught, and we want to introduce some small phi naught, and consider the change in the expectation value of the operator in the CFT. And let's think about just finite temperature now. So it's nu is zero, just finite temperature. And as you take the limit where phi goes to zero, this is given by, let's think about the frequency, let's think about momentum space. No. So this is, you can think of the omega as a complex variable if you want. So this, where this thing is the retarded Green's function of this operator with itself. So let's just think about a diagonal element. And then just for simplicity, maybe some of you will be disappointed, I'm just going to think about the very long wavelength behavior. So just zero momentum, zero frequency, in which case this Green's function is proportional to some transport coefficient, which I'll just generically call chi, times phi naught. And so so interesting special cases of chi are the case when the operator O is a current and the source is a gauge field, like we've been saying, in which case this change in the expectation value of the current is, in which case this transport coefficient is, this formula is just Ohm's law, and the transport coefficient is sigma, is the conductivity. The other example, which I'll focus on, is the case when the operator involved is this particular component of the stress tensor, this sort of shear component, in which case the source is the mode of the boundary metric, the mode of the metric in the bulk with the opposite indices, and in which case the chi that appears there is the shear viscosity. Right, so this, I mean, the thing I've written here is just equivalent to the Kubo formula for the shear viscosity. Okay, and so let's consider in a gravity dual. So suppose there's some equilibrium configuration with a gravity dual, which describes an equilibrium configuration, where the metric, we can be very general about the metric. So the equilibrium solution is a bit like this. So I'm just going to assume it's diagonal. There's a GTT. There's a radial component. And there's some spatial components. And the assumptions I'm going to make about this is, first of all, that it approaches ADS as z goes to 0. So z is still the radial coordinate. And the second thing is I'm going to assume that there's a horizon like the Schwarzschild horizon, so that the GTT goes to minus 2 kappa. I don't know if I got this right. ZH minus Z, it has a simple 0. Z minus ZH. Maybe I want a minus sign there. And GZZ has a pole at the same place, whose coefficient is the... Right, so, and in between, it can do whatever it wants. It should solve the equations of motion. The argument that I'm about to show also applies in the case when even the boundary behavior is something else. So, for example, if the thing is asymptotically Schrodinger space, if it's this dual of a non-relativistic CFT. In this space-time, let's consider a probe, which will be the field involved here, and let's let its action be minus half b equals 1x squared of g, and it has some kinetic term, and then I'm going to put some arbitrary function here. There can be some function of z here, which I'll call q. And suppose this phi here couples to some operator O, and the only important assumption I'm making about this is that it's massless. Right? So there's no mass term in there. And an example of the setup, the one you should keep in mind, is this case where we set phi equal to this. So think of this particular kind of fluctuation of the metric. In the case where we allow the momentum to only be in a direction perpendicular to x and y, I guess I should have said that. The momentum in the x and y direction is 0. And in that case, the form of the Einstein action evaluated on this particular fluctuation, looking at the variation of the Einstein-Hilbert action with respect to this particular mode, it's of this form. It's of the form of a minimally coupled scalar, where the only thing I need to say is this factor q is equal to the Newton constant. And I guess you should pay attention to the pi's in what I'm about to say. The pi's and the 4's. I need you to remember that we derived this formula for the expectation value of some operator in the CFT. And this formula applies also at finite temperature. Which, in the case of a massless scalar field, all you have to do is evaluate its field momentum. So phi is the conjugate momentum of the scalar. Evaluate it in the solution. That's what the underline means, and just take the limit as it goes to the boundary. And given this formula and this relationship between the Green's function and the expectation value, this tells us that this transport coefficient, which let's to the case where it's the viscosity, is the limit of the following ratio. Let's think about the momentum space case. The momentum divided by I omega, that's just this factor of I omega, the field. So this is just the same formula that this is just G is equal to B over A. And we have to take the limit where Z goes to the boundary, and K goes to 0, and then omega goes to 0. Where this order of limits is important. But that's just the familiar one from linear response theory. OK, so we'll do this in two steps. Yeah. I think I must be tired. It's getting heavier. It's undergoing gravitational collapse. So two steps. First, we're going to evaluate it at the black hole horizon. We're going to evaluate that ratio at z equals zh, and then we're going to try to move that result, propagate that result to the boundary. Okay, so the first step is near the horizon, and you'll see why I'm starting at the horizon. So the horizon is a regular singular point of the wave equation. So given this information, you can show the equation of motion coming from that action in momentum space, it's an ordinary differential equation as a function of z. It has a regular single point at zh. And the form of the solution near there is, you can figure out just by the usual way of plugging in some power law on nuts, is of this form. Okay. And so there's of course two solutions. Let's call them A plus minus. And I claim that the one with the plus is the one that describes stuff falling into the black hole. The one with the minus describes stuff coming out. And so since the one with since stuff falls in and doesn't come out, we should pick the one with the plus if we want to compute the retarded Green's function. Okay. So this is the causal one. So we pick that one. And given that, we can evaluate this field momentum. So it's just that the variation of that action with respect to the radial derivative of phi, which is square root of g over q, gzz dz of phi. So this is just differentiating that action with respect to d phi. And so if you take this expression and plug in this behavior here, just explicitly plug it in, pi of zh and k, you get 1 over q of zh. And here I'm doing a little bit of juggling of terms here. The I omega comes from differentiation with respect to z. And differentiation with respect to z, evaluated at z equals zh. Okay? So you can all imagine doing this calculation. If we had chosen the wrong boundary, if we chosen the outgoing boundary condition to compute the advanced Green's function, we would get a minus here. Okay, the second step is to propagate this to the boundary. And here our work is actually very easy. So to figure out how this momentum varies when we vary z, we just use the equations of motion. Right? This thing is proportional to some second derivative of phi, which is the thing that appears in the equation of motion. So by juggling these terms around, you can see that this is equal to a bunch of stuff plus terms involving k. Acting on phi. Right? So here I'm just using the equation of motion. And I forget actually what goes there. But it's, yes, please. Okay. Oh, it's just some arbitrary function. It's just a show of bravado that the calculation works. No, so you should think of it as arising from something in the solution. It's spontaneous. Good. Thank you for emphasis. So for the case of the viscosity calculation for Einstein gravity, the form of the action is just q is 1 over 16 pi g. In some other kinds of weird theories where there are higher derivative terms, the thing that goes there is some more general thing. And so that's something I'll come back to. Good. And so it's not too hard to convince yourself that this is something which, when you take k to 0 and omega goes to 0, in the special case of a massless scalar field, this is where it was important that the thing was massless, this is just 0. And similarly, you can convince yourself that dz of phi omega in this limit is also 0. And so the conclusion from this is that pi over omega phi, which is the thing, which is the Green's function, is the thing we need to evaluate at the boundary. So if we take it to the boundary, we get the Green's function. This is this is just in the special case when we take all these limits. I should give that a name. Okay, in the limit where we take k to 0. Yeah. Okay. this means k and omega are 0, it doesn't change. It doesn't change between the boundary and the horizon. So we start at the horizon, we have some answer, and that's actually just equal to the answer at the boundary, which is equal to this coefficient. And so we conclude from this that the viscosity is 1 over, or the more general, whatever the transport coefficient is 1 over q, this function at the horizon, times this particular combination of metric factors, g divided by gdz gtt. Okay, now let's look at what the entropy density is in a metric of the form that we just wrote. So this thing has a horizon at z equals dh, and just plugging in that form of the metric. Oh, I guess I'm sorry. I think I'm making it. No. Okay, sorry. Plugging that in, the area of the horizon, this is the area density divided by 4g, is equal to 1 over 4gn times a very familiar combination of these coefficients. The absolute value is just because gtt is negative. And so comparing these two expressions, you see that, eta over s, in the case of Einstein gravity, is equal to 1 over 4 pi, which is this famous result of Compton Sun Stearns. And so this is a very interesting value, maybe I shouldn't. Should I draw the picture of the values of the viscosity of various substances? Maybe I won't. Maybe I'll skip it. Maybe Pavel will talk about this. I guess I should say this is a value of viscosity which is smaller than the value of any observed substance, except the things that come closest to such a perfect fluid are you get about a half for fermions at unitarity, and maybe 0.16 is a good value for the fireball at Rick. And something that's interesting to notice is that we got this answer for any theory with a gravity dual is Einstein gravity. So this is a dramatic example of this kind of uber universality that I was going on about last time. But something to notice is that this is not a lower bound, because as I mentioned, if we study some weird theory of gravity, we instead get eta is 1 over q times s. And so, for example, in Gauss-Bonnet gravity, maybe this isn't EV, but in that case, the answer you get is, in consistent examples, is 8 over s is it's 1 minus 4 times some coefficient, which is the Gauss-Bonnet coefficient, which has to be less than 16 over 25 in order for the world, for things not to go faster than light. And so this is something slightly less than this value. But so anyway, that's the value. Okay, so this was the calculation of a transport coefficient using this real-time technique. Are there any questions about the idea of the calculation? Really, it's just the same idea as the two. Yeah, this was... Yeah, so this is a trick that was introduced by Hong and his student, which it only works in the special case of these sort of transport coefficients of things coming from massless fields in the book. Say again? This particular trick of okay. Uh-huh. Good. And I see, that's special to the massless case. I see. Good. Yeah, no, you're... Okay, good. I'm sorry, yes. Good. Right, I guess I should also mention that there is some intuition to be had about why this was the answer from the point of view of what the calculation is doing in the bulk, which is that the calculation we're doing from the bulk is, so this phi that we're talking about here is some particular mode of the metric. Its excitations are something you might call a graviton. And the thing we're doing is sending in gravitons from the boundary at the black hole and measuring how many come out. And so it's this transport coefficient is proportional to the imaginary part of that amplitude, which by some optical theorem is related to the cross section. And so the statement that this cross section is proportional to the entropy of the black hole, perhaps not too surprising, given that the entropy is related to the area of the black hole, right? So it's saying that the cross section for scattering off the black hole is some kind of geometrical cross section. So that I was supposed to say about an intuition for why that's the right answer. Yeah, I'm sorry. So my attributions to Hung were mostly motivated by the fact that I was using his machinery explicitly here. Yeah. Completely general. So let me emphasize. Yeah, that's a good point. So the assumptions that you need to make to get 1/4 pi here are that that the field theory has a gravity dual, which is described by Einstein gravity, meaning the action for the metric is the Einstein-Hilbert term, and not some complicated series of higher derivative corrections to that. So with that assumption, this result is completely general. It means that there are corrections to it. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So the is the Einstein statement. The generality, if I put in this factor of Q, I can incorporate the effects of those higher derivative terms. So I should emphasize that in order to do that, I have to know the black hole solution in the presence of those higher derivative terms, which is why I mentioned this only for this very special case, which probably doesn't exist. And this calculation, in fact, requires very detailed knowledge, as Diego has emphasized to me, of the particular values of those coefficients, because you have to actually find the black hole solution in that background. Actually figuring out what that Q is for some particular funny theory of gravity is a hard thing to do. Yes. Good. Good. Ah, yes. You're right. Good. Right, good. Right. And certainly also it was very important that single mode was described by a massless field, right? So.
There are two reasons why you might not get that behavior. That's an infinite coupling behavior. So one reason why you might not get that number is because you're not really at this infinite coupling. You're close, but not exactly. The other reason is maybe your theory is infinite coupling that's close to the coupling.
Right. So certainly, it's not a coincidence that the things that come closest are things that we know are strong coupling. It's a little bit stronger than just large N. Right. So there can be other couplings in the system that we need to be big. So for example, okay. I'm going to do the thing that I promised myself I wouldn't do. In the case of the N equals 4 super Yang Mills theory, there's this line of fixed points, and it's only in the limit where at the extreme end of that line of fixed points that this is exactly the answer. And I mention that only because it's an example over which we have a great deal of control, not because the correspondence is special to systems with supersymmetry. Good. Good. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah. So actually, I'm pretty much done. I just have a few concluding remarks to make. So there are three quick things I want to do. I want to mention that in addition to the observables that I've talked about, there are a few other observables that are quite interesting, so that can be computed easily using this correspondence. Some of them are relatively specific to gauge theories, such as, for example, it's very easy to compute Wilson loops. But one observable that's of very general interest is that there's a prescription using gravity to compute entanglement entropies. So I felt like it was important to mention this, since entanglement entropy is something that's notoriously hard to compute in other ways, and also very interesting. And the prescription is the following. So if we divide up, so this is the boundary, divide up, say, space, and I guess this is the only case in which it's known, divide up space into two regions, then and trace over the degrees of freedom in one of them. So let me call the region, the surface separating the two regions, sigma. Then we can, for any state of the theory, for example, the ground state, we can construct a density matrix which traces over, say, the stuff in here of whatever the state is. And the entanglement entropy is this, is just the von Neumann entropy of that density matrix. And a conjecture way to calculate this, which has been tested in a number of interesting ways and passes most of the tests, is that this is equal to the extremum in the over surfaces in the bulk which end on that curve over so this, let's call this M, things in the bulk, so this is the z direction, whose boundary is that, and you just extremize the area of that surface and divide by this ubiquitous factor of 4 times the Newton constant. So, okay. And this, so this usually works. And it gives, yeah, okay. The penultimate thing I want to say is just a few lessons for how to use ADS-CFT to do physics. So one lesson is critical exponents. So the dimensions of operators in the CFT depend on what you might call landscape issues, by which I mean just that they depend on the coefficients, the couplings in the bulk action, which are set by, you have to pick some vacuum of some theory of quantum gravity, and we don't know which are the values which have the blessing of the UV theory. Well, yeah, yes, yes, right. But from a practical perspective, this means that we can't really compute them. Right. So these things depend on those. Right. That's exactly what I mean. Including the higher derivative. Yes. So there is a thing to say about higher derivative terms, which is that if you change the degree of the equation, so that the ordinary differential equation you're solving is more than second order, it really means that you're describing more than one operator. Really, you sort of integrated out something, and you're solving the equation for two things at once. Yeah. Exactly. That's right. So I'm just emphasizing that maybe this isn't what we should be trying to compute. Okay, so the second thing is, at least in the examples we know, thermodynamics, so maybe, I don't know, maybe other people know this for other reasons, thermodynamics is not so different between weak and strong coupling. Small and large coupling. And so I say this because in some examples which we understand very well, so like the calculation that I showed to you, the answer at strong coupling is actually just some order one fraction of the answer at weak coupling. So this is true in the n equals 4 supering mills, and it's true from lattice results in QCD. I don't know if it's true more generally, but this says that maybe, you know, this isn't the most dramatic effect of strong coupling. But on the other hand, Number three, real-time dynamics and things and transport is different between weak and strong coupling because, for example, this ratio of the shear viscosity to the entropy density in a perturbative gauge theory, so weak coupling, is something that goes like inverse powers of the coupling. And this is much, much bigger numerically than the answer that we got at this in this arbitrarily strongly coupled theory, which was something like 1/4 pi. And not that, but it's not so hard to do this calculation, whereas this one was not so easy. Okay, and so then I want to end with just a final philosophical comment, which is the following. So I'm sure many of you know this this famous experiment proposed by Weisskopf, which is you take a bunch of theoretical physicists and from birth, and you lock them in a building and never expose them to anything in the liquid phase. It's a Gedanken experiment, and you ask whether they would predict the existence of this phase of matter from first principles. Just say again. No, part of the obstacle to doing the experiment. and Weisskopf's prediction for the result of this experiment is that the answer would be no. And the reason for this is that the existence of the liquid phase requires the stuff making up the liquid to interact strongly with each other. And I think the same question goes for any other phased matter or critical theory which relies for its existence on the presence of strong interactions. So, for example, I think you could say the same thing about confinement. So take a bunch of physicists who aren't made made from the degrees of freedom of an asymptotically free gauge theory, and ask whether they would predict confinement in gauge theory. You could say the same thing about the fractional quantum Hall effect, and maybe even superconductivity. And we can argue about that one. If anybody has more things to add to this list, please tell me. I think that's right. I think because physicists rely for their predictions of new such things on weak coupling, on the existence of some description in terms of quasi particles, or on the poor experimentalists to actually build the system, right? This is really Hong's claim. So suppose we didn't know about QCD, but we know idiocy of T. Suppose we don't know anything about the dynamics of QCD. So here's the picture of the dual level conformal field theory that I've been trying to tell you about. It. You have a bunch of copies of Minkowski space and this radial coordinate, which goes on forever. This is the dual level of CFT. It's very simple using this information to. I guess I already drew this picture. Using this information to find solutions. I mean, the Klebanov-Strassler solution is a little bit complicated, but it's not as hard as solving QCD. Where the only difference between these two things is that here the radial direction ends, I think it's a reasonable prediction that we would have predicted confinement if we knew ADS-C of T before we knew about QCD. I think this is an important lesson to keep that our ability to imagine such things has been in the past limited by descriptions involving weakly interacting quasi particles, whereas here, I mean, it may be some limited class of theories. Maybe they have to have lots of degrees of freedom per point. Maybe they have to be related somehow to gauge theories. I'm not sure, but at least they are strongly interacting. For sure, we know that constituents are strongly interacting, and so maybe they do stuff that we haven't imagined, and maybe people have already seen it in experiments, and we just haven't. So okay, that's the end.